What's it like to be blind? To be a lawyer, a philosopher, an Uber driver? To scuba dive for the first time or to skydive for the 500th time? What's it like to have 6 months to live? To go to prison? To be gay in India? What's it like to quit a job and travel the country in a van? Join us as we explore human experiences to answer the simple question, what's it like? You can write in any questions, comments, or feedback for the episode on our Twitter, at What's It Like Pod. That's at What's It Like Pod, P-O-D. Make sure you hit follow to keep up to date with the latest episodes and content. Or you can send us an email on whatsitlike@munchermedia.com, where you can give us comments or even suggest other topics for future episodes. What's It Like is a Muncher Media production. Muncher creates other great podcasts, such as The Pursuit of Wellness, a show about holistic health. If wellness is a journey, The Pursuit of Wellness is the playlist. Check it out at munchermedia.com or iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. So with that, let's jump into the conversation. I hope you find it as illuminating as I did. So if somebody asked you at a party, what do you do? What do you say?
I'm an advocate. I try to keep it short for the most part because explaining it is a bit of a task if you don't know what an advocate does, because there are various categories of us. I just normally leave it at advocate, and then if someone shows a lot of interest, then maybe I'll elaborate.
So I'm definitely one of those people who would not know what an advocate means. To me, it's somewhere between what I understand a lawyer to do in terms of documents, papers, filings, etc., all the way till what I see on suits.
So you have basically two types of advocates. One would be your corporate advocates who would do non-court related work. For example, mergers or drafting of agreements, securities offerings, things like that. But again, they're involved more on the legal part of it, reviewing documents, making sure there are no loopholes, than the commercial business side of it, which is normally taken care of by the companies. Then the second category of lawyers where I fall would be your litigation lawyers, in which also you have broadly two categories, civil and criminal. I would be a civil litigating lawyer. And within civil, now you have a lot of specializations coming in. I mean, IPR, intellectual property would be one. Tax law is one. Service law is one. I do generally commercial civil litigation, which covers a bit of everything, but is not a niche category in itself. Now you know why I refrain from giving a detailed answer.
Yeah. So could you walk us through the path you took to being a civil litigator?
Well, it was my abandonment of science which led me to law, because in my 11th and 12th, I had taken science wanting to get into IIT or some engineering college and then see what I want to do from there. But physics and chemistry that was taught was not to my liking too much, nor was I very interested in it. So I knew I didn't want to do science. And my parents are both advocates. So I think that naturally tilted me towards law, not that there was any pressure from their side. But I think that was the reason why I sort of started thinking about law as a subject. And you have to prepare for exams. Colleges have separate exams. So the curriculum for those exams is something which I found interesting. I mean, it was general knowledge, political science, which I thought was not a bad read. And whatever basics of law you're supposed to do, I also found interesting then. So I took those exams, and that's how I started to get interested in law.
Could you give an example of the basics that you're talking about that you found intriguing?
It's a skill involving problem solving, in a sense, especially litigation more than corporate law. Because what you are faced with on a daily basis is a fact situation, and you have to apply the law as you know it to somehow help your client. So there will always, I mean, you'll have a lot of repetitive cases as well. But there is a lot of scope for getting new and interesting problems almost on a daily basis. So coming back to my path, that's how I got into law school, which actually was ultimately based on my 12th aggregate rather than my marks in these exams, which interested me. But the more I did of law, the more I realized it is something I'm very interested in. And at the same time, I also did quite a few internships, and particularly those with litigating lawyers. are the ones which interested me the most. Because there I got to see how life would be as a litigating lawyer. And therefore, my focus throughout the 5 years of law school, or rather at the back of my head, I wanted to get into litigation. But I did try out other internships. But I mean, be that as it may, my interest in law is what never waned during these 5 years. After law school, I did my master's from Cornell, which was again a general LLM because there was no field I was specifically interested in. In fact, I ended up doing a lot of jurisprudence and political theory over there, which is something that I am very happy about even to this day, even though it has zero practical significance in terms of what I'm doing now. After my master's, I got the chance to intern with a law firm in New York for 2 months, which in their corporate division, which I took because it was in the middle of New York. It was in Manhattan. And I had never really stayed in a big American city prior to that. Cornell, I mean, it's a great university, but it is located in Ithaca, which is 5 hours from New York and is primarily the university and nothing else. So I was there for 2 months. They liked my work. They kept me on for 1 year because of the visa requirements not being very onerous at that time for them. And after that, though, I mean, even though I enjoyed working there, I realized that corporate law is not something that is well suited to my taste, for the reason that a large part of what you do as a corporate lawyer is reviewing papers and in aiding businessmen do their work. Your independent role in terms of what goes on in a transaction is very limited. And that, according to me, this is the case even when you are about 45, 50 and you're a partner level employee and you have your own clients, etc. Even then, because you're not a businessman, there is only so much you can do. Whereas in litigation, you are essentially the mouthpiece of your client. You're representing them before a third person in an environment that is best suited to your skills. So therefore, the amount of independence and contribution that you can then give is much higher than you can as a corporate lawyer, according to me.
So how long were you in New York?
1 year. And then I came back to Delhi. And I was working with a big law firm in India for about 6-7 months, after which I joined a chamber, by which I mean 3 lawyers, each with their separate practice, functioning out of the same office. And I was with them for about 2 years, after which I am presently working with a senior counsel for about 1.5 years.
So what did you think of your experience moving back to India, working in the same field, even though you were doing corporate law in New York and move to a different field in India? How would you compare your 2 experiences working at the firms in New York versus Delhi?
But surprisingly, I thought the way they were structured was very similar. That is, in terms of how you manage your emails, your sharing of documents, etc. But beyond that, I don't think it's fair to compare corporate law in America versus litigation in India. I am not really in a position to compare corporate law or litigation in US with corporate law and litigation in India, because I have done 1 in US and 1 in India. But the big difference that I know of in litigation in India that is not there in the US is the fact that your senior counsels, who are so designated by a high court or a supreme court, are able to charge, well, without any offense to them, exorbitant sums for appearing in court on a daily basis, which is a practice that is virtually unheard of in US at least. And as per my knowledge, in most countries. In fact, one of the common jokes that were cracked on me when I was in US was how easy it is to make money in litigation, and how they were sort of envious of me that I'm going back to do litigation in Delhi.
It strikes me that doing law in India as graduation, or what they would call undergrad in the US, is much more of a commitment than it is in the US and perhaps other parts of the world, where I suppose they call it pre-law, and you kind of sit for an exam afterwards, and really your specialization is in law and not so much your graduation. Do you have a sense of these programs and how effective they are in terms of imparting law education? Could you evaluate your own 5-year law school in the context of law schools everywhere else in the world?
According to me, a law does not deserve to be a 5-year subject. I mean, and in hindsight, it's one of the great regrets of my life not to have done a 3+3, which is your graduation or pre-law, and then my law school in a standard 3-year course. And a big reason for that is I feel you don't, like I said, you don't need 5 years to do law. And what happens as a result is you end up wasting those 2 years. Rather than gaining a year, which is the idea of doing a graduation plus undergrad and graduation in 5 years instead of six, you are losing out on the ability to specialize in a separate field by giving up on your graduation. So, I mean, like I said, my view, which has only been reinforced after I did my master's in Cornell, is that I would have been much better off doing a graduation in something like economics, philosophy, whatever interested me at that point of time, and then doing my law. And to get to your second question, I feel law as a field is taken much more seriously in US for the simple reason that, you're culturally, you pay for yourself after your undergrad there to a certain extent, which is not the practice here at all. And because of the costs of universities, people who end up doing law are normally more serious about it. And secondly, I feel because of the fact that they have already done a graduation and they are about 20, 21 at that point, it's a more conscious decision on their part to get into law. Right after school, as it is done here in India, I don't feel 60, 50, 60, whatever percentage of kids are really ready to do law. I mean, it's something that is both a mixture of it being forced upon them and them having some sort of a desire or interest in law.
Which law school did you go to?
ILS, Pune.
And could you talk about your experience there? And in the context of what you just said, what were the attrition rates like in terms of people who stayed in law? And did you have the sense that the people you were surrounded by were not as passionate as perhaps they would be in the 3+3 scenario?
So ILS would be different to the national law schools, which is, the premier law schools in the country, about 10 of them, out of which 3 would be in a category of their own. But even the other 7 would come before any other law school. So ILS is separate. And ILS is also very different because it takes about 300 students, as opposed to a national law school, which takes about 60 to 70. Because of this, you don't know everyone in your batch. It's physically impossible to know 1,500 people because you have 5 batches. Quite a few of my friends did end up doing different things after law. That being said, in ILS, a lot of my close friends at least ended up doing litigation or corporate law. But that is not always the case. I mean, the other people who I know, or my colleagues who are from different colleges, quite a few of them, a majority of their friends did not end up doing law. And again, for me, the reason is because I feel you're too young at 17 to decide what you want to do. To get back to your question to what ILS was like, and again, no offense to this college, it influenced my thinking in many ways, but it was the opposite of what motivational and inspiring should be. We basically had 2-hour classes 6 days a week for the first 2 years, 3 years, and then we had 3-hour classes 6 days a week for the next 2, with there being only one set of exams twice a year. The professors did not teach law the way it should be taught. It was more a case of simply dictating and taking down pointers to write in the exams. The exams themselves were not practical application based, but were rote memory based. So you would get questions like, what is the history behind section XYZ of ABC Act? Which is not something which requires you to apply yourself, but something for which you need to know what the section is and what is the law behind it, which is rote learning essentially. And again, not something I'm proud of, but I think about 60% of my learning would have happened through a guidebook. So this is very different from a national law school where it is more structured, you have regular tests, etc. But there too, from what I've heard, the quality of professors isn't very high. I feel that's a general problem we are facing in the world, in fact, right now, but in India particularly. So while my experience in ILS wasn't good for me as a student then, I feel the biggest positive of it was that it made me really look forward to start working. Because essentially, the best I could take out of it was 5 years of joblessness must mean that I do something meaningful afterwards.
Is it kind of like going to medical school where it's almost a little vocational in nature? Did it have any breadth whatsoever? Or was it just sort of law every semester, every class?
No, so in fact, the first 2 years, we only did 2 law subjects. We had 12 courses in total, out of which 2 were law, 4 were English, 2 were political science, 2 were history, and 1, I forget the other 2. But I think 1 was law, 1 was non-law. First year was completely non-law. the core law subject started only third year onwards. But even then, I mean, in a national law school, I can imagine the students, because of the sheer workload, not necessarily the quality of teaching, only thinking about what they're studying in the classroom. But in ILS, that was never the case because, A, the way we were taught did not inspire much interest. And on top of that, we had exams twice a year. So the normal way for a student to function was to somehow get the minimum attendance, not focus too much on learning what they are being taught, and to simply study 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks before the exam, depending on, you know, what suits them. The only good part is that because law is a very general field in the sense of, as an arguing lawyer, you don't only need to know law, but you also need to have a basic understanding of how the world works in terms of economics, governance, political theory, etc. Therefore, moot courts and debates were in many ways a natural extension, at least for me. So those two things are hobbies that I picked up during my time at law school. So for me, it was never vocational in nature because we were never absorbed enough in the subject. It only became vocational when we used to do a moot court, in which case your entire energy was focused on solving that problem and, by necessary implication, understanding the areas of law involved in that.
What is the recruiting like on campus or in a college? And what is the process to actually get into internships and the firms that you eventually want to get into full time? And also, how important are grades to that dynamic?
There are two ways you can broadly get a job in litigation or in corporate law. I think we can club them together for this purpose. One, which is equally prevalent in both, is to apply through your college's placement cell, which now all colleges have. And depending on the rating of the college or how well regarded it is, you will accordingly get that category of people coming to recruit you. But of course, this is only for so many students. The second category, which is a lot tougher in corporate law, but more common in litigation, is to directly approach the person you want to work with. In litigation, it's easier because you have a lot of small to mid-sized offices which are doing exceedingly well. And all your senior counsels is essentially a one-man chamber with his colleagues or his juniors. So therefore, with them, a college placement and an individual applying are not that different. So therefore, you have an equal chance. Whereas in a law firm, it's very, very tough to get through separately from the college placement set. That being said, this is India, and the third most common way of getting a job is through contacts, which is also extremely common. And the problem in litigation is compounded many, many times over by the fact that you have a hierarchy of junior and senior counsel. And then on top of that, you have judges. So therefore, when a senior counsel requests a junior, or when a judge requests a senior counsel or a junior counsel for placing someone who they know, it becomes very tough for the person being requested to say no. And I mean, I'm sure this is a problem which is there in all professions, but it is also there in litigation and corporate law.
Do you think this is something that's India specific?
I guess maybe more so than other countries, but I don't know if that would be a fair statement, actually. Because in all fairness, during my stay in US, I noticed this practice existing in a few other law firms. But again, this is just two or three law firms where people from my LLM were also working. So that's not really a holistic picture, but I can say for a fact that it is much more in India than what it should ideally be. Also, coming back to what you'd asked earlier, grades are extremely important if you're applying to the college placement cell. But then again, the relevance of grades diminishes once you get selected for the interview. Because an interview is equally important, and more so if you're applying for a job in litigation.
So they say that lawyers, bankers, and doctors have rough initial years in their career in terms of the hours they have to work, work-life balance, perhaps even the quality of work. Is that a fair statement for the lawyer part?
I think this answer would vary from the perspective of a corporate lawyer and that of a litigating lawyer. From the point of view of a litigating lawyer, the first, I would say, at least 5 years are going to be very unrewarding in terms of monetary compensation and working hours. Because you will essentially be doing a lot of the groundwork, which would involve drafting, which is fun to a certain extent, but can get monotonous after 2-3 years if you've done a sufficient volume of it for those 2-3 years. You would also be doing a lot of marking of documents, numbering of pages, making sure the file is in order, etc., etc. All of which you learn after 4-5 months. But you need to keep on doing them again and again till they're like, till it's like a habit to you. So therefore, I would say it is not very rewarding at all. And on top of that, you are essentially working as a representative of the client. He has paid you money for your legal services. So therefore, there will inevitably be days where the client will call you in the evening or call your senior in the evening. Say he wants a filing done the next morning. It has to be done. And you'll have to do it one way or the other. You don't sleep. You don't eat. It's all irrelevant. It has to be done. So you do it. So your work-life balance definitely suffers. And another reason why at least lawyers have very long working hours is the time they spend in court, which does not apply to doctors or other professions. Therefore, on many days, even though I would have reached office at 10 o'clock or 9:30, or I would have reached court at 10:30 in the morning, I would essentially start my drafting and all my other work preparing for the next day's matters only by 5 o'clock, 5:30 when I come back from court. As appealing as it sounds to think that lawyers are able to get work done while in court, in practice, it is a very tricky thing to achieve. Because you have to understand that if you are practicing in the High Court, Supreme Court, or any of the trial courts, after 2 or 3 years of working there, you know a lot of lawyers. And therefore, a lot of your time ends up getting utilized just saying hi to your friends. It's as simple as that, as opposed to getting work done.
Could you walk us through what a typical day might look like in the early years, particularly one that includes going to court? I think we can all imagine what it's like to maybe work at a desk, in a chamber, in something resembling an office, working with documents. But very few of us have the experience of going to court and considering it a workplace. What is a typical experience on a day-to-day basis there like?
Like I said, the first few years, this would vary from a senior's office to a filing counsel's office. I worked at a filing counsel's cum arguing counsel's office.
Could you just clarify the difference between the two?
By filing, I mean filing a document before the court. This distinction between a filing counsel and an arguing counsel for this reason does not exist in corporate law. You just have a corporate lawyer. But in litigation, you have a clear demarcation between counsels who file and counsels who argue, who are also called senior counsels. A senior counsel is so designated by a high court or by a supreme court, where the judges all vote. The big distinction would be a senior counsel cannot file. By law, he is barred from filing before the court. The reason, again, being that once you've reached a certain level, you should then give way or you should stop filing so that other counsels can also come up. And the other big difference in the two is, as a filing counsel, you take liability for what is said. You are responsible for what your client says because you are the one who is, in most of the cases, vetting it, drafting it, making sure it's making out that case. As an arguing counsel, you are to a certain extent only as good as what has been filed before the court. Unless you can come out with a brilliant point of law, but that only happens so many times. Coming back to the day-to-day timetable of a litigating lawyer. Well, actually, before I answer that, I think this is something which applies across all professions. But in litigation, you have two categories of lawyers, one who take their work seriously and one who don't. And because litigation has very specific rules of procedure, if you're a lawyer who is that serious about your work, it is a time-consuming task because you need to literally cross all the T's and dot all the I's. For example, when I initiate a claim before a court, which is called a suit, for recovery of money, wherein I supplied goods to someone, but the person didn't pay me, so I want my money now. When the person against whom I have filed the suit is filing a reply to that, which is called a written statement, in law, he is bound to deny each and every positive statement of fact I have made in the suit. If he doesn't deny it, it is deemed to be an admission. Now, in many cases, the courts leniently interpret this provision. But if you are an advocate who takes their job seriously, you would not want to rely on the leniency of the court. You would instead want to make sure that you have positively disputed all statements of fact. Unfortunately, not all lawyers do it, but get away with it because the courts are of the opinion that the client should never suffer for the mistakes of a lawyer, and which is fair to a certain extent. But the point I'm trying to make is your working hours vary greatly on how seriously you take your job. Fortunately, I was working with a filing counsel who took her job extremely seriously. And therefore, the learning and the working hours were both immense. For me, a typical day would be I used to come into office around 9:30 or maybe reach court at 10:30, depending on, I think, the schedule more than anything else. I would be in court about 3 to 4 days a week. On an average, say between 10 a.m. to lunch. After coming back, I would normally continue with my pending drafting, which would basically mean when someone has, say, filed a recovery action, filing a reply to that or preparing a recovery action, whatever documents have to be filed in court, preparing those or preparing for the next day's matters. Preparing for the next day's matters could be very light when the matter is listed for a procedural issue wherein there is no positive decision which the court has to give, as opposed to a matter which is listed for final arguments or for arguments on an interim application. That is a order passed during the pendency of a litigation for a interim relief. In which case, I would need to maybe make a note for the court, maybe a note for my senior and get some relevant case laws if the need arises. Within those few hours in court, between 10 to 1, 10 to 4, again, it depends from day to day. Sometimes you get free very early. The way court works here is, for example, the Delhi High Court has about 35 courtrooms, about 9 with 2 judges and the rest with a single judge. Each court has a cause list. A cause list has 2 parts to it, or rather 3 parts to it. One is a list of all your fresh matters that are coming up for the first time before the court, which are taken up first in priority. Then you have something known as an advanced list, which are earlier matters which have been specifically listed for that day by an order of an earlier date. And then you have your regular matters, which are taken up only if the court can finish the first 2 categories, which are listed for final arguments. That is where all filings are complete and the court only has to hear the sides argue and pass an order or pass a final judgment. So for regular matters, as a practice, you normally don't go before lunch because you know the court will at least take till lunch to finish it off. Otherwise, depending on the list you reach court, as a rule of thumb, if you're in the first 15 matters, you would want to be in court by 10:30, 10:45. Court starts at 10:30. Beyond that, it depends on the judge and it depends on your schedule otherwise during the day. There are many cases or there are many days when you're just waiting in court because, say, 2 matters before you, the matter just goes on and it goes on for the entire day sometimes. In which case, it depends on you if you want to just, you know, it sounds a bit casual, but hang out in court, meet your friends, you know, or if you want to go back to office or work, which actually many times is not an option because the matter may just collapse anytime.
Is it anything like the popular representation in media that you see of court? And perhaps correspondingly, how would you rate the popular representation of lawyers that you see in media as well?
I have not seen Suits. The only legal show I would have seen would be Boston Legal. And I feel there, the comparison can't be right because there you have a jury system. And therefore, according to me, the quality of arguments that you make to impress a jury full of laymen is very different from the quality of arguments you must make before judges who are experienced in the field. Which is not to say you don't have melodramatic arguments in India or in the High Court or Supreme Court, you do. But it's a different type of drama that is going on. And it depends from judge to judge. I don't think they accurately depict how litigation is conducted in India.
What about in Indian media?
The only thing I can think of would be Jolly LLB and there was one more which I'm forgetting now. But no, not even close. I mean, for starters, I think the one with Arshad Varsi has him filing a PIL before a trial court, which cannot be done.
PIL is?
Is a public interest litigation. You cannot file it in a trial court. It has to be done in a high court or supreme court. Even otherwise, the way evidence is recorded, the way the court is conducted is completely contrary to procedure.
So what, according to you, makes a good lawyer? And what are some things that kids could spot within themselves, teenagers that is, that would enable them to realize that they might be successful in this field?
I think 3 things which you need to be a good lawyer, which I feel are applicable to other professions as well, would be patience, intelligence, and hard work, all in equal measure. Beyond these 3, I think, depending on what type of law you want to do, your telltale signs change accordingly. I can, for example, say in litigation, eloquence and the ability to think on your feet. And by litigation, I mean as an arguing counsel, which is always 15 to 20 years after law school, would be eloquence and the ability to think on your feet are very, very important. And by ability to think on your feet, I specific, and this is not something which I feel a person in school can ever know if they're good at or not. But by ability to think on your feet, I mean to be prepared for getting strange, unexpected questions from the court and responding to them on the spot without giving up on your case or what your client wants. Which sounds very basic and as something which you would think anyone would be prepared for. But that doesn't end up being the case normally. Because as a counsel, particularly when you are practicing in the Supreme Court or before an appellate court, by which I mean not a fact-finding court, you always narrow down your focus to two or three essential points in a case, which you will argue. And therefore, when the court asks you something which is completely unrelated to it, it is very easy to falter. More in addition to these, what I have just said, I can't think of any telltale signs. And a large reason for that is I don't believe that you can make such an important decision when you're in high school. Not even close to it. In fact, I feel before joining law or before joining a LLB course, a person should ideally do an internship or two or otherwise be very certain that this is what they want to do in life before becoming a lawyer. Unfortunately, and I'm sure you're also aware, there's been a great increase in the number of law schools and the number of people interested in pursuing law over the last 10 years. I mean, I know when my father was doing law, it was looked upon as something which is for rejects. It was not at all what a bright young man should be doing. And he was an exception to the rule then. However, I think over the last 10 years, and I think this was highlighted the most by the Vodafone case, where Vodafone was taxed a lot of money for selling its assets, a lot of which were in India. So the Indian authorities taxed essentially a transaction between two foreign companies, where I believe Mr. Salve and Mr. Singhvi, who are two very, very prominent senior counsels, charged astronomical sums for appearing before the Bombay High Court and the Supreme Court, if I remember correctly. And this made people aware of the sums which seniors at that level demand. And of course, the amounts they were charging then were not what is paid to a senior on a day-to-day basis. But a top senior counsel who's there in the Supreme Court would be charging at least, and by top I mean to the top 10, would be charging at least 5 to 7 lakhs for one hearing. On an average, they would have about 5 such matters at least on a daily basis. Therefore, it is very easy to picture why someone would want to do law, because this is what you're really looking at. However, what they are not able to account for at that young age is that to get to that level, all these lawyers have done nothing but grind and grind for the first 20 years. And this is not something which they'll ever tell you in law school. But the first 4-5 years, even though involve a lot of hard work, they are not nearly as tough as the next 5-7 years, because it is in those 5-7 years that you are starting to set yourselves up as a lawyer. And in that period, you're not relying so much on your hard work and intelligence, which I find easier to do, but you're relying on clients coming to you to sustain yourself as a practicing lawyer, which is very tough to do. And a big reason for that, of course, is the fact that I feel Delhi, particularly right now, I can't say about India, but Delhi has many, many, many more laws than what it needs.
If I could ask a more ignorant question here, like, is there any role that memory ends up playing? Because in my head, lawyers need to memorize a tremendous amount of law, for lack of better words, and acts and information that they need to be able to call upon and also constantly utilize to make their case. Is that something that's a big positive if you're planning to be a lawyer?
Yes, having a good memory and a good reading speed are both essential. Because a large part of what you do is read, 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 read. You read your files, your case laws, your expositions of what a law should be, or commentaries, that is, by scholars. And therefore, the faster you read and absorb, the better lawyer you would be. In fact, the biggest advantage which a senior counsel has over someone who's, say, 10 years into the profession would be the stored up experience that he has, which comes to the fore when he's presented with a fact situation. In fact, this reminds me of a book I was reading on memory, where they were comparing the brain of a fresh chess player and a experienced chess player when they were faced with a similar situation. The areas of a brain of the experienced chess player, who I'm comparing to a senior counsel, which lit up when he saw the board, were not those of logic or of applying yourself, but were those of applying your past experience to this. It was something they had already done before, and all they had to do was recall that, and then the move was obvious. And that is the same thing for seniors. If you need 5 steps to get to the solution, the senior would already by memory recall 3 or 4 and would only have to get 1 more step. Whereas for a junior counsel, you would need to get all 5 things together with 5 different points of law, 5 different authorities. A senior would just do it in a much more smoother manner if he has that recall ability.
What do you think sort of is the underbelly of this profession? A lot of times when you think lawyers, particularly in things like criminal cases, or lawyers do represent the bad guys, that's their job as well. You know, people who you know may actually be guilty, and lawyers definitely know that from time to time. Do you see it day to day? Is it something that is sort of unsaid amongst fellow lawyers? Is it something that lawyers wrestle with, in your opinion?
Definitely. For example, in criminal law, I won't even call it an underbelly. It's almost a known fact that if there is, say, a frivolous FIR against me, and I'm going on the assumption that it is in fact a frivolous FIR, I would not be able to get it quashed for the asking simply by saying so much to the cop. The only way for me to do it would be by paying the cop some money, getting him to file a report which says no case made out, and then taking that before a court. The ideal way for this to have happened would be for the cop to have done so himself, and for me to have naturally gone to the court because I know it's a frivolous FIR. Or for example, if I want to file a frivolous FIR against someone and even get them arrested after warrants are issued if required, all I have to do is pay the cop and it will be done. Of course, the arrest may not be sustained for a long time, but that doesn't prevent the immediate harassment. And unfortunately, criminal lawyers play the part of the broker between the client and the cop many, many times. In fact, there will be quite a few cases where there'll be simply a broker who doesn't get any commission, who just facilitates the transaction. But you would be a bad criminal lawyer if you don't facilitate this connection between the client and the cop. It sounds bizarre, but it would almost be a dereliction of duty for you to do the legal thing here, because that is how the system ends up working. So that's one example of how in criminal litigation, you have this very dark side to it. In civil litigation, I think the dark side is not that apparent, but it exists in the sheer volume of cases that you have. I feel that people are way too litigious, one reason being lawyers don't advise them properly in many cases, because a lawyer, by filing a bad case, is still filing a case and therefore charging a fee for it. It may just be dismissed, but he's made his money from it, and clients don't always realize it. In fact, I have had experiences where I have advised a client, told him not to go ahead with something, and I have seen him file an action on that very same thing later on. It is tough to imagine what his lawyer would have advised him for him to have done that. But the point is that lawyers do give wrong advice many times to increase the scope of the work they will get. That's one. And I also feel a second practice is of taking adjournments and of flouting the timeline set by the court. Many, many matters, or rather, on a daily basis, if a court has 50 matters, in a trial court, lawyers would ask for adjournments in about 25 to 30 of them. In the high court, maybe 15, 20 matters, and the judge would grant it in 10. But that is far too high a number. And these adjournments are not sought because of genuine difficulties. They are sought on many occasions because the client wants the matter to just be hanging on to build pressure. Or maybe the client is fearful of an adverse order. or maybe he's enjoying a favorable interim order which will continue to operate. And therefore, this art of getting adjournments, if it deserves to be called that, can be a great disadvantage to an honest litigant. Luckily, a lot of seniors don't do it. But on many cases, you take a senior just because it will be easier to get an adjournment because of the senior's face value, which is not how it should be at all. But unfortunately, that's how it ends up being. Lawyers do wrestle with it a lot. For example, and this is something I don't personally agree with, but one of the biggest criticisms you hear about the Supreme Court is that how it is very, very partial to seniors, and how if you get a known face, by known face I mean a top senior, you're more likely to get an order than if you were to argue. I feel this is untrue of the Supreme Court for the simple reason that presently I feel the Supreme Court has a brilliant judges who are presiding over the courts. And in my experience, if you're prepared as a junior counsel, you will not run into this problem. All you get by virtue of being a senior is some amount of leniency and nothing more. It is very rare for a court to substantively give a different decision just because a senior is there. However, the difference lies in the fact that the Supreme Court, when it's dealing with these matters, has very little time. And therefore, you need to have the ability to make your point in those 1 or 2 minutes that you have. Because, in fact, that is also a stretch about the 30 seconds that you have. Because the court is listening to 60 fresh matters on Monday and Friday, all of which it has read for the first time. It is normally sitting in appeal over decision of two lower courts. So you really need to make out a convincing case to get an order from the court. However, there is a very common tendency to confuse the skill of presenting a case in 30 seconds with face value of the senior and so equate it to the senior having a good equation with the judge, etc., etc. But yes, the young lawyers grapple with this issue a lot.
As we close out this conversation, I just want to give you the floor a little bit to talk about what you see as next for your career. What do you think your likely path would be? And also, maybe just broadly, could you give us a sense of, as much as this would be meaningful, are you happy with your career choice? Do you find it fulfilling?
Yes. And the reason for that is the fact that at the back of my mind, I am very excited to be in a position where other people come and brief me on a matter as an arguing counsel. That is where I am not involved in the filing side of it too much, but my focus is on reading the case and thinking of what is the best way possible of putting it across to the court, which is essentially what an arguing counsel does. Of course, to get to that stage, you have to grind a lot. You have to do a lot of filings. You have to appear in a lot of matters, etc., etc. But reaching that stage is what excites me a lot. I mean, unless I have a change of heart somewhere down the line, I am happy with my job and I feel fulfilled, so to speak. But that being said, for anyone who wants to get into litigation particularly, the biggest piece of advice I can give, which was given to me by my senior, is that don't restrict yourself only to law. That would be the biggest mistake you can make. The moment you decide that you want to be an arguing counsel, I'm presuming you also want to argue constitutional questions or questions involving legislations or how they should be interpreted. And when you're making these arguments in court, your knowledge of the world of philosophy, political theory, economics, even day-to-day affairs is extremely important. And therefore, I mean, a general piece of advice that I would want to give to anyone wanting to pursue law would be not to restrict yourself to law too much. Be, in general terms, a reader and a scholar, and that will greatly help you as a lawyer.
It sounds like a great place to leave it. Thanks for speaking with me.
All right, my pleasure.